Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest this week is City of Syracuse Mayor Ben Walsh. He's just begun the fourth year of his term as mayor, and last month he delivered his State of the City address. It was a virtual address this year, delivered from the Salt City Market in downtown Syracuse. Mayor Walsh, welcome back to the program.
Happy to be back on with you, Grant. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So a lot of my questions come out of your State of the City address, which was very wide ranging. So I'll kind of be covering the waterfront here, and we might end up moving more quickly from topic to topic than we normally do. But let me just start with this. One of the things that struck me is you're very clearly excited about this newly opened Salt City Market downtown. And as I just mentioned, you chose to deliver your speech from there. I've been being super cautious during COVID, so I haven't been down there yet. But from the pictures I've seen, it looks great. Can you tell us a little bit about it and why you're so excited over it?
Happy to, Grant. It's a beautiful facility, and I'm really excited about it for a few reasons. One, hopefully you've heard me now talk about our vision, which was one of the first things that we did when I came into office back in 2018. Our vision is for Syracuse to be a growing city that embraces diversity and creates opportunity for all. And the Salt City Market is the embodiment of that vision. It's growth. We built a new building there, millions of dollars of a new investment. We're embracing our community's diversity. We have businesses representing cultures and communities from around the world. And we're creating opportunity for all. There are 10 new small businesses in that facility. And so it really does, again, embody that vision. And I think on top of that, just given what we've been through over the past year in the pandemic, to have that new, bright, beautiful facility open up at a time when we're all looking for reasons to be hopeful and excited, I think the timing couldn't have been better. And I think that's reflected in how the community has received it since it's open.
And my understanding is it's mixed use. There's residential units above it. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. And to that point, again, getting back to the vision, it's not just your run-of-the-mill standard market rate apartments. They're mixed income. So we at the city use some of our federal home dollars to subsidize some of those units to make sure that people at varying income levels could live there. So again, it's just another way in which it truly is for all.
And are people in there occupying those units yet, or is it too early for that?
I believe they're in there, and they're still doing some final touches on the project, but it's virtually complete.
Oh, I have to get down there as soon as I can. When you discussed in your speech the pandemic and the challenges that it's causing for the city and the area and the nation, there was a group of workers that you called out for praise, and it's one that we don't typically hear included, along with healthcare workers and people working in grocery stores or teachers. And that was the folks who work for the government, and in your instance, city government. Why was that so important for you to make that connection?
Well, I couldn't do my job without the hundreds of dedicated public officials that serve the city. And I've witnessed firsthand the sacrifices that our city workers have made, the ways in which they've gone above and beyond, and at a time when their job has never been harder, and we've never asked more of them. We've had to make really difficult financial decisions because of the devastating financial impact of COVID. We've had to furlough virtually all of those workers, yet they show up every day. They do their job. They often aren't heralded in the same way some of our other essential workers are. And I'm so grateful for the dedicated public servants that we have in the city. And anytime I can lift them up and give them the credit they deserve, I try to do that.
One of the things that might be related to COVID, I wanted to get your take on this, but it's a troubling change, and it's all over the country, but we've also seen it in Syracuse. And that is a spike in violent crime and homicide. And again, it's happened in Syracuse. And along with that, there's also been an increase in the incidents of police getting shot at and citizens resisting arrest. What do you think's going on there this year?
Well, I think it's going to take years for us to fully understand the impact that the pandemic has had on people's lives, on people's health, and particularly mental health. The statistics speak for themselves. While overall crime was down this past year, violent crime was up. We saw that across the country. And so clearly the pandemic is influencing people's behaviors in that regard. And we have seen that as it relates to interactions between law enforcement and the community. And we know, given what we all went through in 2020, in light of the murder of George Floyd and all of the discussions and protests that followed, that's a particular point of contention and concern for all of us. So in many ways, the pandemic just really accelerated some of those issues, really shined a light on them and increased the level of urgency to address them.
Do you think that some of the protests that happened in the aftermath of the Floyd killing may have somehow emboldened people in their interactions with police, or, you know, somehow maybe emboldened the criminals that are the ones that are perpetrating the homicides?
I don't think so. No, I see the protests that occurred as a good thing. They again shined a light on issues that we've been dealing with in this community and across the country for a very long time. And so, and they've led to, as I've said, you know, we were focused on police reform before 2020 and had made significant progress, but the calls to action from the community undoubtedly accelerated our progress and increased the sense of urgency. I think that we're going to study it for a long time, but I think what you've seen in terms of some of those negative interactions between individuals and law enforcement are due to broader, more complicated issues, but certainly the impact that the pandemic has had on mental health, I think, contributes.
When you and I spoke last time, I think it was in the fall, we spoke at length about this issue with the police. Is there anything particularly notable that has been done in the last couple months since we've spoken? You listed a number of things that the police department was engaged in, that your office was engaged in.
Yeah, so going back to June of 2020, I issued my executive order, which included 16 specific actions that I called upon the police department to take relative to police reform. And we've been ticking away and making significant progress on virtually all of those since then. And we've created a web portal that tracks our progress. We want to be transparent and open about the progress that we're making. I think one of the more recent elements that is worth noting is that around the same time that I issued my executive order, Governor Cuomo issued an executive order around police reform that required all municipalities with law enforcement agencies to actually develop police reform plans. So we are nearing the end of that process. There is a draft plan in front of the Common Council right now. It's largely a summary of the work that we've been doing, but it does include a number of new actions that we are taking consistent with our approach. It can be confusing to people to try to keep track of the various efforts, but we've done our best to make sure that we're aligning those efforts. In this particular case, we're working with a countywide group of stakeholders, but we do have a plan specific to the city that's in front of the council for adoption. So that the work continues, and we expect that that will happen, you know, for years to come.
I'm Grant Reher. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and I'm speaking with Syracuse Mayor Ben Walsh. So there was something in your speech that caught my ear. It may have seemed like a detail to a lot of people, but I was particularly interested in it, in part because I've written on this in the past when it's been done in other places, but it's a new effort that you were describing to involve the public more in the city budgeting process by using digital technology in order to let residents play around with the budget numbers through a virtual budgeting process and then send their input, what they've learned from doing that, to the city. Tell us a bit about that process and what you're hoping that it accomplishes.
Grant, that's why I appreciate you, the fact that that stuck out among the many things I discussed. But yeah, city budgeting is a critically important component of the work that we do. And when citizens engage on any variety of issues, oftentimes funding comes up. And if done properly, our constituents should have a direct involvement in that process. But it's hard. It's complicated. There's a lot of numbers. There's a lot of nuances. So there's a tool called Balancing Act. It's a software program that basically assists in engaging the community, visually shows where how funding is allocated, and gives people the opportunity to adjust that funding. So you understand if we're having a conversation about funding for the police department, for example, which again gets back to one of the discussions around police reform, you have a better understanding of if you impact that budget, how it impacts other things. So Syracuse City School District has used the tool for a number of years now. We are incorporating it into our process this year. We are going to focus on the police department among some of the other larger departments. But you know, we want the public to be engaged. Once that budget is in place, that's what drives our work over the course of the next year. It's a step towards participatory budgeting, which is a concept that that intrigues me. Again, the idea being that we give citizens a direct hand in making those decisions beyond just hiring or electing common counselors to do that. So it's a small but significant step towards a more community engaged process.
Yeah, one of the things that other places have found when they've done this and people have actually engaged in it is it's a great byproduct of it is they get a better appreciation for how difficult budgeting is, you know, because a lot of times citizens will say, oh, you know, what are those jerks in City Hall doing? It's so obvious. But then you say, okay, here you go. You know, it has to balance. Let's see you do it. And people get an appreciation of that. Are you hoping that that's going to be something that people will get out of it as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, you know, one thing I think is an example of that people don't fully understand, don't fully appreciate is the cost of people, of staff. That's the vast majority of the budget in each of our departments. And when you take that out, you realize how, you know, relatively speaking, little there is left to work with in terms of, you know, programming. So that's just one example. But yes, the idea is certainly to give people a better understanding and appreciation of the difficult decisions that are being made, but also ultimately it's to empower them to help us in making those decisions.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with City of Syracuse Mayor Ben Walsh. Well, I've got another wonky question for you that you'll probably love here, but I also noticed listening to your speech that when it comes to the actual administration of government, you know, paying fees, managing information, the permitting process, those kinds of things, there was a clear theme, I think, in your speech of centralization and consolidation in order to try to make things both easier and cheaper. Could you just explain your thinking and your approach in that regard?
Sure. I think I want to note that when you use the term consolidation, that's a loaded term that gets people's backs up. You know, we have not done any consolidation between other governments, right. But we have done a good amount of consolidation and centralization within city government to make sure it's operating as efficiently and effectively as possible. There's a lot of systems in city government that are largely or have been decentralized that I think have resulted in inefficiencies. So, you know, our central payment office, for example, people do business with the city on a daily basis, whether it's getting a permit, paying taxes, paying water bills, and we've created a new central payment office on the ground floor of City Hall that once we're back open to the public, will help make that process more customer friendly, but also more efficient on the back end. Similarly, with our permit process, we've spent a lot of time looking at how we can make that process more efficient. Budgeting is another one. You know, we We talked about the police budget. We're actually bringing that process into the budget office. It was up to this point done within the department. And I think it helps us to, again, have a better sense of how we're maximizing our limited resources. And it's been successful. It's hard work. It's change that people are not used to in government, but we've made a lot of progress in just 3 years.
That was one thing I wanted to ask you about in that regard, because I imagine that some of this probably threatens some sacred cows and some desire to maintain familiarity on the part of the staff with the way things had been done. So how do you manage that transition? It's tough to get people to move sometimes.
Yeah, I'm still learning that every day. You talk about moving. Just today, we have employees of CityLine, which is our centralized customer service function that are physically moving from out in DPW to right across the hall from me. And again, that's part of an intentional effort to centralize the way in which we deliver our services to the public. So sometimes it means people are literally physically moving, and other times it's their job titles or department alignments. But, you know, it's as much as possible, we try to engage those individuals, that staff in coming up with the new process, and then actually empowering them to help us make those decisions. Certainly engaging with our labor leaders to make sure that the unions are on board is an important component. But again, we're learning every day, but we've made a lot of progress.
And then you also mentioned that the city is now repaving almost four times as much road as it did in the past. So how'd you pull that off?
Well, paving roads, filling potholes, it's one of those quintessential fundamental components of local government. And when I came in here, in addition to kind of the big vision and big initiatives like Syracuse Surge, I wanted to work on the fundamentals, and road street paving is one of them. I give a lot of credit to our DPW Commissioner Jeremy Robinson, our Chief Operating Officer Corey Dunham, for taking on the challenge and looking at efficiencies. And one of the most significant ones is that I don't think people understand how much the cost of curbing goes into road reconstruction. Hmm. And so we are replacing less granite curb than we typically did. That still is an important part of the process, but what we found is oftentimes it was just assumed that we would do that on every project, and that ate up a lot of the cost. So just being more surgical with our approach, also being more data-driven. We now work with SMTC, the Syracuse Metropolitan Transportation Council, to do an annual rating of our roads, which was never done before. We had DPW employees that did kind of a windshield survey, but we've got SMTC now doing that. So it's helping to prioritize what roads we're repaving to make sure we're getting the most out of our dollars.
Well, a really big issue now, arguably the big issue for the city beyond dealing with the pandemic, and that's the replacement of I-81. And it does seem now that it's well established the community grid is going to be the way forward. One looming concern, though, regarding this is the displacement of the, particularly the poorest residents, but the displacement of a lot of the residents that currently live in the area where there's going to be new construction. And it has been an issue for other cities where there have been the use of redevelopment models that are similar to the main one that's being circulated in Syracuse. Another concern is that the jobs that are going to be created by that construction include a large number of people from the area. So I know those are huge topics, but what are some of the things that you're looking at and doing to help avoid the outcome of over displacement and, on the other hand, underemployment of local people in the project?
Yeah, so as we know, 81 in the replacement of that or the removal of that viaduct has regional implications. But to your question, my top two priorities from the beginning have been to center our efforts around those that live within the shadow of the viaduct and to make sure that we maximize the opportunity to put city residents and local people to work. That's what led to the Syracuse Build program, where we are actually training people to work on that project. That's what a lot of what contributed to the Blueprint 15 initiative, in addition to working with the Syracuse Housing Authority and their redevelopment plans. And that's what led to us ultimately going out and applying for a $1 million grant that we have been awarded from the Enterprise Foundation, specifically to focus around anti-displacement. I've said it from the beginning that we need to make sure that we're not gentrifying this neighborhood as we're investing in it. But listen, for those that that live in that area, for communities that have been affected by gentrification and displacement previously, particularly communities of color, they shouldn't be giving me or the community leadership the benefit of the doubt, because in the past, we do not have a good track record, like most cities, of avoiding that. So I'm trying to show through our actions that this is a priority for us. Again, I think that we have a once in a generation opportunity. I now believe with the Biden administration and with Secretary Buttigieg that we have a partner in the federal government that shares those goals and values. And so I'm more optimistic than ever that we can that we're going to do it right.
When you met with the folks from the Federal Transportation Department, you just referenced Secretary Buttigieg. Did you explicitly talk about this concern with them?
Absolutely. That was the majority of the conversation was around, again, focusing on ensuring that we don't displace people and getting people to work. There was a program in the Obama administration known as SEP 14, which was an experimental program to try to break through some of the procurement bureaucracy on federal transportation projects to help get more local people to work. That program went away during the Trump administration, and now they're looking at bringing that or something similar to it back. We've got the support of our federal delegation on that. And those are those little things that people don't necessarily appreciate, but can have such a transformational impact on communities and these projects. So yes, that was the majority of our conversation. Again, I think we're fully aligned in our priorities and in our values. And it just gave me a taste of the opportunities to come working with this administration that, frankly, I haven't had over the past 3 years. And it wasn't just talking with DOT. It was, hey, you should talk to our colleague in HUD. You should talk to our colleague in the EPA. And again, it has me really excited about the possibilities in the coming years.
It's more of an observation than a question, but if Syracuse was able to get that right, that would be something really new in the country, because it really has been a problem in other areas, and it's a tough tightrope to walk. You want people with more money to come in, but you don't want to displace the other people. So I wish you all the best of luck with that. If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Syracuse Mayor Ben Walsh. I want to try to squeeze in a couple more questions in the 3 or 4 minutes we have left. I want to go back to the police now, and then I've got a kind of a quirky question for you at the end. But you mentioned that you had some disappointment that the city council did not approve a police contract that would have required new officers to live in the city. But you also said you were pleased that there's an effort now at the state level for state legislation to do something like that. I'm just wondering about the weeds on that, because it's a good concept, but let me just give you one scenario and tell me how this would work. How would you deal with, if you had that in place, with the need of some families to be able, after they've been living in the city, to move outside of the city? I mean, let's say an officer starts out with her family living in the city, but then her spouse gets a better job that's 50 miles away, and they decide that it's best for the family to split the commute by locating themselves mid-distance between the city and wherever that other job is. I mean, what do you do? Do you make exceptions on a case-by-case basis, or how does that work?
Well, it really depends on the rule that we put into place. In the contract negotiations, what we had agreed upon with the union was a 5-year residency requirement. So for the first 5 years in the department, you're required to live in the city, which is consistent with what we currently have in place with the fire department. So in that case, after those 5 years, people would have the option to move. What we're currently pursuing with the state legislature would be a residency requirement for all new officers, that they would have to live in the city for the entirety of the time they work in the department. Hmm. It's worth noting that that is currently the case for the majority of city employees. As long as I'm mayor, I'm required to live in the city. And again, outside of police and fire, which I just mentioned, and sanitation workers, which is all related to the same state law, everybody else is required to do that. Hmm. It's not that uncommon. It's not unique. Living in the city is a great thing. I think oftentimes in this, the way we discuss it, it's as if it's some sort of sacrifice. I chose to live in the city because of all of the great assets. When my father was in Congress, he was required to be in Washington, D.C. for a significant portion of his job. It's, I think all industries, many industries have similar requirements. Again, I see it as an asset. Ultimately, I think that having officers living in the city makes for better officers and better relationships within the city.
Well, we've just got about 1 minute left, and one last quirky question here. You said in your speech that your pet peeve for the city was people not following the rules and putting out their trash and debris for pickup, and that you've now appointed an inspector to focus on that particular issue. Okay, so here's my pet peeve.
Okay.
It's beyond the current one of people not wearing their masks. But once we get beyond that, it's not cleaning up after their dogs. Hmm. Is there any hope for a dog poop inspector?
So I'll say that illegal setouts are one of my pet peeves among many, and I think we all have them. Honestly, we have not had much discussion about dog poop. I will say that as we've had more residents move downtown, we've put out more dog poop bag dispensers. So that's all I got for you now, Grant, but I'll consider the seed planted.
Okay. Well, I have to leave it there for now. That was Syracuse Mayor Ben Walsh. And Mayor Walsh, I want to thank you as always for talking with me. And as I said to you the last time we talked, I want to wish good health to you and your family. I look forward to the day when I can just say, be careful you don't catch a cold. But
thank you, Grant. And same to you and your family.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Mark Lavonier. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.